Welcome to Authorial Intentions, a series of conversations about recently published or forthcoming books by faculty in Vanderbilt University's Divinity School and Graduate Department of Religion. I'm Chris Benda, theological librarian at Vanderbilt University's Divinity Library, and today I'll be talking with Len Goodman, professor of philosophy and Andrew W. Mellon professor in the humanities, about his recent book, Coming to Mind, The Soul and Its Body, co-authored with Dennis Caramenico. And I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly.
Yeah. Okay.
Len, thanks again for being willing to be interviewed.
Oh, it's a real pleasure, Chris. It's very enjoyable.
Great. Start off with a pretty general question. Your book, and correct me if I'm mischaracterizing it, but your book is a brief, as far as I see it, it's a brief for soul talk about the soul. And I'm wondering, what's happened that we need to have this book? What's happened in terms
of
soul talk?
Great question, Chris. I think there's a lot of people who are under the impression that the more we know about the brain, the less we're able to believe that there's any such thing as a soul. There's a tendency to think that science has put away that concept, and we're just bodies, and bodies are just mechanisms, and there's a whole host of related notions that people think flow from that idea. We're passive, we're not responsible, we're not free, creativity is just imitation, whole host of erroneous notions, which are based actually on an incorrect idea about what's been happening in brain science. People have bought into a rather out-of-date notion and a project, a reductionistic project about explaining everything in physical terms, which has made them uncomfortable with talking about human souls. And Greg Caramenico and I, he likes to be called Greg, his given name is Dennis. Greg and I wanted to bring people up to date about the brain science and show them that the smart money in brain science, Evan Thompson and others, are taking a much more holistic and a much less reductionistic view of the human person, which we think makes it not only credible but appropriate for us to talk about human souls.
Okay, you've raised a number of issues that we're going to talk about as the interview goes on, and I think probably the crucial one to kind of talk about initially is the whole concept of soul and what it means to you. You and your co-author argue for the importance of the soul, but a couple of the topics that are typically associated with the soul, for example, immortality and God, don't play a huge role in Coming to Mind, although you do have an afterword where you do talk about God. And then beyond this, sort of slightly different take on the soul than what some people might expect, there's seems to be sort of a tension between some of the terminology that comes up in the book. You can see it in the title, soul and mind, you know, what's the difference? And you also use the word self, you and your co-author use the word self throughout the book. So my question is, what do you mean by soul, and why use the word soul rather than mind or self?
Okay, let me. That's also a whole raft of questions.
Yes,
I'll try and address them. I think a lot of people do associate the notion of the soul with immortality. They have a big investment in that. Similarly, there's an issue in about ensoulment, which is relevant to the controversies about abortion and when when does a human being have an identity and so forth. I think that's immortality. I know it's something that many people are very eager to have, and it tends to drive a lot of discussions, both popular and otherwise, about what a soul might be. But I think that's sort of picking up the wrong end of the stick. You don't start out with what you want and then try and figure out what has to be the case in order to get it. That doesn't yield very sound conclusions, and it's not going to be something that's convincing to people who come with an open mind and want to know what a soul could be and what it's possible for them to believe about the human person. So that'll only be sort of preaching to the choir. People who want to be reassured and comforted, and so we find folks saying things at funerals, let's say, which they wouldn't say anyplace else. I don't think that makes for very good philosophy. So the issue about God works a little differently. As you say, we talked a little about God in the afterword of the book, but I think it's a terrible mistake in philosophy to start out with God and say, well, God gave you a soul and therefore X, Y, and Z, P, Q, and R. Once again, you're not going to convince anybody who doesn't already start out with you. I think it's always smarter, whether it's in the realm of ethics or in the realm, as we're dealing here, with philosophical anthropology and psychology. One should work from the ground up rather than try and suspend one's argument from the heavens down. If we find out that it's legitimate to talk about a soul, then we can legitimately ask, how could there be such a thing? Now, there are plenty of non-theists, Raymond Tallis, for example, in England, who take a non-reductionistic approach and have very sensible things to say about the soul, or what we call the soul, even though they don't happen to be theists. I think if one looks at the phenomena that we think one can't deny about the human person and our having souls, then one can argue in that direction. How does one get from what we know to things that might look like they're way beyond us. That is, go from the fact that we know the difference between right and wrong up to God. Go from the fact that we know that there are truths in mathematics which are absolute. Go from there to God. And similarly, go from the fact that the human soul is not just reducible to a matter of mechanics. That would be something that could be explained by the idea, the traditional idea, that that this is a gift of God. Now, another part of your question was about why do we use the word soul at all? And I think part of the reason is that Greg and I felt that the language we use has been impoverished by reticence and hesitancy about the word soul. So in a way, we wanted to do for that word and the concept it stands for something like what Alistair MacIntyre did for the concept of virtue, where people became uncomfortable with the notion of virtue. It had been used for far too narrow a notion. It came to mean chastity, particularly among women. That's too narrow and skewed a notion of virtue. And Alistair MacIntyre, who used to occupy this very office where we're sitting, by the way, successfully rehabilitated the word virtue and gave it back its broader and livelier meaning. In the case of the soul, when one talks about the mind, certainly there are certain aspects of the soul which are cognitive and intellectual, and partly for that reason, people have used the two in some contexts as equivalent, that is, soul and mind. So when we chose that title, which was Greg's idea, Coming to Mind, we're referring to consciousness and awareness, which is a very important aspect of the soul. Some people think that consciousness is very mysterious. We think that it's the most evident thing there is, the one thing you can't deny. Consciousness and awareness, some people think it's very mysterious, as I said. Other people think it's a mystery that's insoluble. I guess when they say that, they're referring to the fact that consciousness is describable only in its own terms and not reducible to physical, mechanical terms. I don't think that's a mystery at all. I think that that's a premise of an argument. If consciousness can't be reduced to mechanism, if there's a distinction between the objective and the subjective has to do with our awareness, which is very primary to us, that's part of the argument for the reality of the soul. But consciousness and the cognitive sphere in general is not the whole of the human reality. The cognitive side, I think when most people think of it, perhaps erroneously, they tend to leave out the emotional side, the areas of commitment and hope and love and caring. If they're thinking of the mind in those terms, they're leaving out an awful lot about what's important about the human person, which the notion of soul successfully captures. That's why poets and songwriters like those who live here in Nashville keep using the word soul, not just because it's a nice old-fashioned word, but because it speaks to and has resonance with all kinds of dimensions of the human personality, which the reductive notion of the mind or the narrower notion of the mind tends to leave out. If you think about French and German, where you have words like esprit in French and Geist in German, those are richer terms, and there's been a tendency to translate those terms when people translate texts from French or German. There's been a tendency to translate them as mind and leave out the broader dimensions of the psyche, which we think should not be left out. And when I speak of those broader dimensions, I think it's important to recognize that they are in reality integrated. That is, our cognition, contrary to the kind of reductive notion of it, our cognition is very committed, very associative, very much involved with values. Yes, with the value of truth, but also with all kinds of other values, the things that we care about. They have cognitive dimensions, and the cognitive has affective dimensions. So I think that the word soul has a broader sense. It's interesting, you know, when Freud's work was translated, we pointed this out in the book, there was a tendency to avoid his use of the word soul. So psychology is the study of the soul, and psychiatry is the effort to treat and improve and heal the soul. But It's certainly not confined to the mind. And I think in philosophy in particular, there was a tendency to reduce the soul to what was commonly thought to be the mind, and then to go ahead and eliminate the mind as well. It's kind of mindlessness. So, I hope that,
yeah,
that justifies.
Sure.
I know you were thinking about other possible terms like self,
mm-hmm,
or person, which one might have used perhaps to avoid getting into discussions about immortality or ensoulment and whatnot.
Right.
There's a wonderful line by one of the authors that we quoted, Richard Sarabji, who is a great Aristotelian, and there's a lot of Aristotelian thinking in the book that Greg and I wrote. Sarabji wrote a book called Self, and he didn't use the word soul so much as we do, but he makes a similar point. Here's what he says. Think about persons. Persons can't always substitute safely for selves, he says, or souls. Epictetus, the great Stoic philosopher, former slave, says, "What did you say, man? Put me in chains? My leg you will put in chains, but my will not even God can conquer." Very Stoic sentiment there. Having been a slave, of course, Epictetus knew exactly what freedom really meant, and how to find the self that affirms that freedom, even when in chains. Here's what Sarabji says about that passage from Epictetus. He says, he's not saying that you cannot change the chain, the person, or the human.
Hmm.
Of course you can. Nor is he saying there's an aspect of me that you cannot chain, namely my will, the tyrant that Epictetus is imagining himself to address, knew that, of course. But rather, he's saying, the aspect of me that you can't chain is the me. That's who I am. That's a nice point that Sarabji makes, and that has to do with one might call the transcendent dimensions of the soul. He's talking about moral transcendence here, not necessarily immortality, but something about who we really are. We're not just our consciousness. We're not just our subconsciousness either. We're not just our will. We're not just our cognition. We're not just our emotions. We're that whole, person. But what makes a person, is what differentiates, let's say, a living person from a dead person. Call that a soul.
Okay. Thank you. I want to shift gears just for a second before we actually get into talking about the content of the book, and ask you a little bit about the process, because you have two authors for the book, and so I'm always kind of curious how that actually works out. So can you talk a little bit about that?
I can. I mentioned the fact that that this room that we're sitting in is actually it's my office, very nice office,
mm-hmm,
but it used to be Alistair McIntyre's office. Greg Caramenico was a former student of mine, a brilliant man, very knowledgeable about brain science, incredibly knowledgeable about literature and history and history of ideas, among many, many other things. I know when Greg was having a little slack time at one point, he decided to learn Farsi and got into some discussion groups with people online, and pretty soon he was just reading the Iranian classics and so forth. Greg is a brilliant man, he had done a little work for me as an RA, and I realized what a rich fund of knowledge and what a powerful memory he has. I thought it would be great. I had it in mind for a long time when I gave my inaugural lecture for the Mellon Chair. I gave a kind of programmatic lecture about a project I'd like to do. The lecture was called "What's in a Soul," and I had in mind some of the themes that come out in this book. But when I got to know Greg and the content of his immense learning and intelligence, I thought we should do this together. Mm. Because of his knowledge of neuroscience and the allied disciplines and the history of those disciplines, which is often neglected by the practitioners in them, what was happening in Italy in the 16th and 17th century and so forth. Mm. And we used to meet here in this room. That's why I mentioned the room. I would sit at the computer and type, and we would talk together, and the language tends to be mine. A lot of the scientific underpinnings are coming from Greg, and we would work this out together. Just about every word or phrase was the product of our joint efforts. That's actually a lot more. Two don't work as fast as one. It's kind of like in the Paul Bunyan stories, you know, where they make fun of the notion that if you want to hear something at a great distance, you get two or three people together and they all listen hard and they'll hear two or three times as far as one does. Two or three people, two people in this case, working together means this takes longer. Mm. And on the other hand, I think that the result is the project comes out more than twice as rich and full. And I think people who have read the book recognize that because there's what he knows and what I know, and then there's the interaction of those two sets of not just knowledge but ideas, playing off each other and learning from each other. It was a very rich, creative sharing process, that was essentially the way we worked together on the book.
So what we're going to do now is actually kind of go into that rich, well, at least sample it.
Okay.
It's a relatively brief book, but it's got a lot of information, a lot of reflection in it, and so there's no way that we can go into incredible detail about it. But that's fine because the listener can then get the book and read it for him or herself. So just to get sort of an overview, your book focuses on five areas: perception, consciousness, memory, agency, and creativity. And you cover each one of these in a chapter. And you trace what I see as sort of a genealogy of how these concepts have been understood and we're talking about understood over centuries, and also discussing, well, how does modern neuroscience consider them? And so what I want to do is just pull out a few of what I think are central themes from the book, and, you know, you're welcome to kind of dip into the individual chapters for specific illustrations and illumination. But we'll just touch on a few of these themes. The first theme I want to ask you about is emergence, which plays a fairly central role in the book. In the introductory chapter, which comes before these five, or your discussion of these five areas, it's a chapter called Bodies and Souls. You posit emergence as a response to the reductionist tendencies that try to find explanations for everything in the smallest elements. And you've already alluded to reductionism several times. Can you talk a little bit about what these reductionist tendencies are, and how emergence addresses them, and then how, you know, what's the soul's relationship to all of this?
Great. First of all, let me say what reduction is and what reductionism is. Reduction is a very respectable and necessary method of thinking and of painting and of science in general. It means abstracting and simplifying and explaining things in terms of their parts or their origins or some simpler story than what appears on the surface. And I say that's a wholesome and necessary a part of any kind of thinking. Think about what a painter does, taking a scene or a bowl of fruit or a person's face and reducing it to two dimensions, reducing it to a series of signals, really, that are meant to suggest something. A novelist or a theorist or a historian does much the same thing. So when Newton says that there's this force which all bodies exert upon one another, directly proportional to their masses and inversely proportional to the square of the distance between them, he's given you a principle which can explain an awful lot of stuff. It's in that sense a very powerful principle, and it gets its power from the variety of situations that it can cover. It can tell you about planetary motions as well as balls rolling down an inclined plane, or objects being dropped from a tower or what have you. Reductionism is the erroneous notion that explanation can and should go only in one direction. And as your question suggested, in reductionism, one is always trying to explain the larger in terms of the smaller and the more complex in terms of what is presumed to be simpler and so forth. One doesn't want to throw out that kind of explanation. However, there are situations where we have to explain the smaller in terms of the larger and the simpler in terms of the more complex. And oftentimes we find that what we were presuming was simpler wasn't really simpler at all. It was more complex than we thought it was. So, for example, in the history of physics, they thought they would find ultimate particles, atoms or subatomic particles, in terms of which everything could be explained. And what they found out was that the properties of those little particles turn out to be much more complicated than we thought they were. They're not just a matter of bodies in motion. Those little subatomic particles don't have simple locations, and they have properties like spin and strangeness and flavor that the physicists like to give them cute names. But they have properties which open up larger windows of complexity. So we have the illusion that we're getting more powerful explanations when we move towards simplicity, and it ain't necessarily so. But I put out the challenge, in addition to what I just said, that sometimes we've got to explain the smaller in terms of the larger. If you look at organisms, you're not going to be able to explain the life of a plant or the behavior of an animal or the actions of a human being in terms of the masses and interactions of the body parts. That's a long-standing project which has repeatedly proved itself to be inadequate. If we want to know why Jim went to the store, we have to know what he wanted to buy there or get there or see there. We're not going to be able to explain that in terms of Newtonian physics or really any kind of physics. Now, emergence is not an alternative to reduction, but it is an emergence theory is an alternative to reductionism. It's saying, hey, don't let's make explanation into a one-way street, and don't make it into the kind of one-way street that has a dead end, by which I mean that extreme kind of reductionism, which is called eliminative reductionism, which first reduces everything to something which is supposedly very simple, and then erases the thing that it was trying to explain. So we'll explain the mind in terms of matter, and that means that we're able to eliminate the notion of mind. It's just an old-fashioned superstition. The idea of emergence, which has been around in explicit terms for over 100 years now, is the idea that complexes, wholes, the larger stuff, can have properties which are not predictable from the subassemblies that they're made out of, and which might not be even explainable in terms of the subassemblies that they're made from. Although you know, sort of, if you knew enough about the complexes, you could make rules which allow you to go back and forth in either direction. A wonderful example of that, chemists are very interested in emergence because it has to do a lot with the important distinction, which is basic to the foundations of chemistry, between a compound and a mixture. Think about table salt. Table salt is a compound, and we know that it's a compound of two elements, basically. There may be some admixtures of other salts in there, but the sodium chloride that's most of the table salt is made up of an extremely volatile grayish metal, which is so active that it'll catch fire if you pour water on it and turn to lye. You have this highly volatile metal, sodium, and then you have this poisonous gas, this poisonous greenish gas. And we have to worry sometimes if a pool is chlorinated, we have to worry that the gas doesn't get out. It can burn and blind people if it gets into the air they're breathing. So we have this poisonous chlorine gas and this volatile metal, and you combine them, and you get a crystal, which is necessary to the sustenance of life here in Nashville. Nashville, in the days when the Indians lived here, was called French Lick, because the French did some trapping here, and the reason they did that trapping was because it was an Indian hunting ground. And the reason it was an Indian hunting ground was that there was a natural salt lick here. And the animals would come and lick the salt because they, well, they knew it or not, they needed salt in their diet or they would die. So here you have this wonderful crystal, table salt, which is made out of a poisonous gas and a volatile metal. It's got properties which you could explain in terms of the valence of the electrons and so forth, how it got those properties. Now that we know what those properties are, we could reason backwards and understand them. But that reductive process doesn't tell you what table salt really is. It has properties which are not the properties of its elements that are constituents to it. And similarly, if I may make an analogy, mm-hmm. a living being has all kinds of capabilities and properties which are not just the capabilities and properties of the matter it's made out of. It can do more kinds of things, and human beings can do more kinds of things too. We talked one time about that book about creation and evolution I wrote. In creation and evolution, one of the things that I'm fascinated by the evolutionary process is the emergence of autonomy. Animals have purposes, and the purposes get more and more self-directed. So when you get to the point where you have human beings and they're actually choosing their purposes and deciding what kind of life they want to lead and what kind of principles they want to live by, what kind of goals they want to choose, you're not going to be able to get that kind of richness out of merely saying, hey, it evolved that way. That's kind of just begging the question. What you're going to have to recognize is that you've got more than you started with. You've got properties and characteristics and behaviors and ideas that weren't there. Consciousness is one of them. Matter isn't conscious, and doesn't have purposes in the same way that animals do, and animals don't have purposes the same way that humans do. So that's what we meant by making emergence a big theme in this book, as a kind of a counterweight to the notion. The hallmark of any kind of reductive story is the use of the word mere. Human beings are a mere bodies, or are mere electrical machines, or consciousness is really just what does Koch say? Your hopes and dreams and aspirations are just a matter of the firing of the electrical, the neurons in your brain. They're certainly not going to take place without the firing of those neurons. We're not trying to set the soul apart from the body. We see an integration of the soul and the body, but the notion that consciousness just is the firing of those neurons misses the point. Consciousness is something made possible by the firing of those neurons, but it's something that goes way beyond that firing.
Cool. Great, thank you. You and your co-author, to turn to another theme that you've also actually sort of gestured towards at one point in our conversation, you talk about passivity.
Yes.
And you argue that passivity has often been stressed in discourse about perception and consciousness. A trivial example of that would be light striking the eye and the eye passively registering that. And that's opposed to the notion that the person has any active contribution to memory, to consciousness, to these ways of, I don't know what to describe these things as, consciousness, memory, perception, how we are in the world. You and your co-author have difficulties with this notion of passivity. Can you talk a little bit about, further than what I have, about this opposition between passivity and the passive and the active, and how this notion developed, and what the soul has to do with this?
Okay, let me state the basic thesis of the book.
Okay,
and that will help. If we say that souls are real, yours and mine and everybody else's, what does that mean? It doesn't mean that you can cut one out and lay it on the scales and weigh it like a piece of liver at the butcher shop. What it means is we premise that if something is active, it's real. if it has causal efficacy, if it can do anything, that's what makes something real. That's the evidence that something is real. So that's the foundational premise of the book, and that's how we can argue that souls are real. We know that souls are real because they act. So that take a realm like perception. That's where you started.
Mm-hmm.
It's a long time ago, but John Locke, who was the author behind the American Declaration of Independence. So he didn't write that, but he wrote the theory that made it possible for our founding fathers to write it. John Locke was the author of a lot of what counts as common sense. And John Locke thought that perception was pretty much a passive affair. He had his own philosophical reasons for thinking that. But since so much of what Locke thought has become common sense, that was a good place to start. You talk about light striking the eye. You know what the eye does, and I mean the eye before it ever gets to the brain. What the eye does when light strikes it is anything but passive.
Mm-hmm.
What's active and what passive there is very interactive. When light strikes the eye, there are receptors, there are cones and rods which respond, and they undergo chemical changes, and they send electrical messages on the optic nerves to the brain. And long before those signals have actually gotten to the brain, it happens very fast, so I shouldn't say long before, but certainly well before those signals have gotten to the brain, they're integrated and interpreted. That's how we're able to know what color something is. The process, and we walk the reader through this in the book,
mm-hmm.
the process by which we perceive colors is anything but passive. It's a highly complex, integrative process. Hume, who was very much influenced by Locke, thought that we perceive sort of simple colors like a particular shade of blue or something like that. That's not how it works. We've got to construct those colors, and we do it in a combination of electrical signals. We do the same thing with smells really all the so-called simple, what early 20th century philosophers used to call sense data. They were looking for kind of atoms of sensory perception. There aren't any such atoms. They're all elaborate constructs done by comparisons both in the sensory apparatus and beyond it in the brain. Long before, well before it becomes associative. In this case, except in the case of smell, smell gets to be associative practically at the beginning of the chain of events. These are fascinating processes in which the human brain takes an active part. Remember that we're not setting up a zero-sum explanatory game where the more you explain in terms of the brain, the less you know about the soul. We think the brain is the organ of the soul, and this is how it's done. But the active character of this process belies the notion that this is merely a mechanical response, a passive response to a stimulus, which unfortunately is the way a lot of people still think that such processes work. Memory is an interesting case because memory is extremely associative and extremely constructive and extremely integrative. But even at the level of perception, One of the things that happened, it's a kind of a sad story that comes out of history, but a sad story with a happier ending. A lot of the psychologists in German-speaking countries in the 20s and 30s were very interested in what they called Gestalt psychology. That was pattern recognition. And these guys did fascinating work. Some of them did work on the perception of color. One of them, Johannes Itten, was teaching color theory at the Bauhaus before the Nazis closed it down. Another of them was foundational in the birth of abstract expressionism and the relational perception of colors, so that a color will look darker or redder or pinker or bluer, depending on the framework in which it's perceived. And this is something that great artists have their own natural feel for. You'll see it in the work, of any great artist, but you can see it. There are lots of examples from Van Gogh or other artists, and in folk art too. These relationships, the dynamics of these relationships are dealt with. The Gestalt psychologists, many of them, got out of Europe and wound up in America in the World War II and immediately post-war period. They were at odds with these kind of rigidity of Central and Eastern European thinking. When they came to America, they were very disadvantaged, both because they were non-English-speaking refugees and because America in the early 50s and beyond was dominated by the behaviorists. And these Gestalt psychologists were much more holistic in their view of the nature of the psyche, and they tended to be marginalized. They wound up teaching at art schools or designing camouflage uniforms or various other sorts of jobs. Their work was marginalized, too. It continued. But their work was rediscovered in the 70s, 80s, 90s, and beyond. And new empirical studies have found the neurological, the brain science behind what these guys were observing, whether it had to do with the thought process or the learning process, as in the case of Wertheimer, who was kind of militating against the rigidity of pedagogical techniques in Europe as he was a young man. New empirical work has confirmed and enlarged upon what the Gestalt psychologists were showing. Because their work was showing the integrative and active character of the human mind, and much of this was cognitive, but it wasn't all cognitive. It had to do with emotions as well. It had to do with the processes of creativity. Their work is very simpatico to what Greg and I had to say, because they lay a foundation in the understanding, for example, why it is that a little toddler, or even before a toddler, as they're first beginning to talk, can recognize a dog. And that's a category. That's a perceptual category. It's not that they have some kind of concept of a dog, which they then apply. It's not coming from language. Language is coming from it. And that's why you'll find the little kid, as he's learning language, will, for a brief time, call any big furry squishy thing, oh, goggy, right? What that means is they're perceiving something as a dog. That's a level of perception that obviously goes beyond what the optic nerve is doing, but it's the kind of thing that the brain is doing for us. which is a vast network of highly active, highly associative processes. When you come to memory, and Greg has a particular expertise in memory and a particular commitment to it, when it comes to memory, we have a section in the book about the work of Eric Kandel. And this brilliant man devoted his life to what was called the search for the engram. There was this notion that memory must be a set of traces. It's an image that's used by Plato and picked up by the Stoics and lasts forever. Memory must be a series of traces, like the impression made by a signet ring. And we're going to find the place where these memory traces are. We're going to show that memory is the imprint of some kind of sensation upon some region of the brain. And guess what? it turns out that's not how memory works at all. Memory is not a series of traces. It is an active, constructive process. Memories are owned by the subject who owns them. So there's always the it's my memory, not thy memory. And there's every time we have a memory, whether it pops up by itself or seemingly by itself, or whether we sort of call it to mind, when we have a memory, what we're really doing is reconstructing elements of some experience, actual or potential or imagined. Part of the reconstructive, and Ulrich Neisser dealt with this to some extent, part of the reconstructive activity is that memories are continuously revised and reinvented, sometimes fictional, but we find that memory, rather than being the passive imprint of perceptions or other events, memory is an active, associative, integrative process. It doesn't have a particular location because the memories that we have are, if you actually do the functional MRIs, they're lighting up in all sorts of different places because of the associative character, the emotional character of various memories, and so forth. It's a very good example of the sort of thing that we're interested in. I had a particular investment in the chapter on creativity. It's a subject that has interested me for a long, long time. I alluded earlier to the fact that people who are very mechanistic and thus very reductionistic tend in various ways to eliminate the notion of creativity. They don't think that there's any such thing. So they turn it into a matter of imitation, or sometimes if they're so inclined, they turn it into a matter of external inspiration. But the real inspiration comes when we think a thought that wasn't thought before. It doesn't come out of the blue. It comes by working with materials that we know. We have a nice example in the book about Picasso and the Demoiselle of Avignon, where every figure in that famous and revolutionary painting is a commentary on and a rejection of certain classical or primitive or other tribal models of the way a figure might be represented. Numerous studies. It doesn't happen magically. It doesn't happen by accident, which is another reductionistic way of getting rid of it. It happens by contributing something of oneself to the given. Memory is a creativity is a dialogue between oneself and the traditions one responds to, that's another example of the activity of the person. I'm sure we're going to talk about agency and the freedom of the will. But that would be another example of the kind of activity which leads us to say that souls are real.
Another thing that I wanted to ask about, and this was actually one of the more interesting aspects of one of the more interesting ideas or themes that came out, was the whole notion of souls as souls in relation to humans as social creatures. So
yes.
Souls and sociality. So could you talk a little bit about that? What's the connection between...
Right. Obviously, on one level, the soul is very personal and very private.
Mm-hmm.
I am I, and you are you, and I know what I know, and you know what you know, and we don't just sort of merge into one big puddle. And yet, we are not unconnected. We connect with one another through language, through feeling, through relations of dependency and cooperation and collaboration. In the chapter on memory, we talk about the social dimensions of memory. History is part of the social dimensions of memory, where we're trying to construct a shared account, taking cognizance of one another's experience and creating a story which would fairly and we hope faithfully reflect the intersubjectivity which arises from comparing notes and comparing perspectives and that's something which is facilitated by language, but it only it doesn't occur only at the level of language. Even in the infant mother dyad, just as there's shared perception which leads to the emergence of an individual consciousness and an individual soul, so there's shared memory and talking things over. People who are very utilitarian think that tribal people go out and hunt. If you're really an observer, you'll find that after the people come back from the hunt, they sit down and tell the hunt. That's an important part of their life. No less important to them than the food they got on the hunt, and you can see that. Go to the barbershop or the mall. You'll hear people talking about last weekend's big game, and what should the guy have done, and how did it work out. That business of sharing experience is very important to the constitution of our identity, because our identity, which is what our soul is, our identity is not an atomic isolate any more than our perceptions are atoms. Our identity is on one level very private and very personal, and on another level very active and very social, and we know, you know, persons who have difficulty with those social dimensions of experience. That's a serious difficulty for them. That's autism. They have trouble relating to other human beings very often, regardless, I can't pretend to be an expert on what causes that. I don't think it's caused by vaccines, but I can tell you that it's very gratifying and very rewarding for autistic children when they begin with the right kind of therapy to break down those barriers, sometimes Sometimes you'll find an autistic child maybe can't relate to other persons, but can relate to a horse or a dog. And you can see that desire and that welcoming of some kind of social reciprocity and interaction. I think that's the autistic children making that breakthrough is kind of the exception that proves the rule about the social nature of human beings. But I want to caution folks, I live in a philosophy department, and in a philosophy department, whenever somebody has an idea, somebody thinks it's the idea. We have to watch out for that. When I say that we are social beings and sort of echo Aristotle saying that man is a zoon politikon, a being of the city, an animal who lives in social units, I don't want to encourage the mistaken notion that we are constituted by our sociality and that there's no person there at all. That relationality is active and alive because there's a person there, and that person is reaching out and connecting with other persons. You try and reduce the human soul to its social dimensions, and you'll wind up with a network with no nodes. That's what I called in my very earliest book, first published in 1972, still in print, what I called the zero-sum argument. The point zero argument, excuse me, I'm just quote myself. The point zero argument. You explain everything in terms of something else, and you wind up with nothing by which to explain that which you set out to explain. So, yeah, we are social beings, but we are not creatures of our sociality.
Right. Where do non-human animals fit into the discourse on souls? And I ask you this partly because you actually bring up quite a bit of research in the book about non-human animals.
I don't think it's foreign or inappropriate at all. But again, we have to watch out for the reductionism.
Right.
The soul in the human case is a very special kind of a thing. There are levels of interaction and levels of discourse and levels of thinking and experience and emotion and ideas. Think about what a mathematician knows. All kinds of realms which have never been encountered perceptually by anyone. But this mathematician knows a lot about them and is eager to learn more about them. These are not things that animals can do or would be interested in doing. But animals are alive. If you take your text from Aristotle, that's enough to say that they have a soul. It's not a human soul, it's an animal soul. Aristotle thought that even plants have souls. And he didn't mean some mysterious entity that's hovering above them. He meant that's the life principle in them. That's the way they operate as the kind of organism that they are. If you believe in evolution, as I do, you see not just a continuum as though we're all on one straight line, but you see a variety. Even within an individual species, you see a variety. My wife likes to ride, and she's a very social person. She and the other ladies who ride have their own horses, and the horses have different, personalities, right? This horse is friendly, and that horse is responsible, and the other horse is a pain in the neck, this horse is testing you to see what it can get away with. It would be foolish to deny that animals have goals and purposes and intentions. You go down to the barn and you find that the horse, like a very little kid, is testing you. to see what it can get away with. And once it knows, it's very reassured and can deal with that. And when the messages it gets are ambiguous or inconsistent, that's confusing and upsetting to this animal. But horses as my wife explains to me, horses are not only herd animals, which makes them very, very social, more so than us, but they're also prey animals. That means their world is divided into two main categories, things that one might be able to eat and things that one might be eaten by. And anything that's a little out of the ordinary is a potential horse eater. And if there's a leaf floating around in the field, the horse might get skittish and might spook. So they have their needs and they have their intentions and they have their emotions and they have their affections. And the person who gives them an apple every now and then is going to get a big whinny when she comes into the barn. And the person who act them once is going to be treated as something to be afraid of or annoyed by, at the very least. Those are elements of those are perfectly consistent with what I'm calling a soul, but they don't amount to a human soul. I get very worried about people who talk about animal rights. That's an application to non-human beings of a category which really only properly belongs to persons. You have what I like to say in my ethical work is that all beings have deserts, and deserts are relative until you get to a certain plateau where you can talk properly about rights and dignity. And I think that the people who use the rhetoric of rights to try and modify the rules and the behaviors of others with regard to the treatment of animals very typically are trying not so much to elevate animals. It's not that they want to give the dog and the cat the vote, but rather to demote the deserts of humans. Peter Singer is a good example. He doesn't wear leather shoes, but he's fine for euthanasia and infanticide. So I think we should be very chary of the notion of applying rights to animals. And I will say, while we're on the subject of animals, we talked about I translated from the Arabic, The Case of the Animals, The Case of the Animals versus Man. Well, my general theory of justice, unlike contractual theories of justice, I've got a very most people who do ethics today don't know how to say anything about animals. John Rawls, who is thought to be the best political philosopher of the 20th century, thought that the reason you should care about the environment, that the only reason we have private property is to protect the environment, because otherwise might foul it. And he doesn't really have any adequate way of dealing with animals at all. And so you get the rhetoric of animal rights against the people who aren't really interested and haven't really thought much about it. I think in my theory of justice, which is in that book called On Justice, if you have deserts, and deserts are scaled according to the claims that any kind of being makes, then you can deal with plants and animals and monuments of nature and culture and assign them their appropriate deserts and how they can cooperate and collaborate, etc. But when you get to the human case, you're talking, or any persons, even if there are non-human persons, maybe in another world, then you can talk about rights, because they have subjecthood, and they can have moral entitlements of that kind because they have moral responsibility, because they can decide and choose what they're going to do, and animals don't do that in exactly the same way. So I think you can approach, certainly we've seen some rule changes with regard to chimps in the very recent past, because they're so close to human that they begin to look like persons. They're not quite moral subjects, but we don't experiment on them the way we used to, and I think that's right. We shouldn't. So you have a continuum, and then you have a plateau where you're really talking about persons. Because I don't derive the entitlements of beings from any kind of contract or convention, as Rawls and others still do, still fighting that 17th century battle, 18th century battle against the divine right of kings. Because I don't derive rights from contracts and conventions, I don't have to worry about beings that can't be signatory to a contract. That would include not only animals, but the unborn and the unwell and the people who are in a coma and all sorts of other beings that have very definite entitlements as persons, as people who used to be persons, people who could become persons, and then and non-persons as well. They have their entitative considerations that are due to them. But as far as souls are concerned, sure. In a different sense, animals have souls. That doesn't mean that they're immortal. That's not part of what my claim is. And it's not part of my claim in the human case either. My concern is to get away from the notion that a human being is just a kind of a piece of meat.
This last question probably arises from my imagination more than your authorial intentions, but it seemed to me that your book's juxtaposition of philosophers and poets with neuroscientists and the way that you value the views of all of these people, I mean, you criticize them, but you also value them, has something to say to the larger question of the relative values of the sciences and the humanities in our time. So to what extent do you see your work contributing to that larger discussion of the humanities and the sciences?
I'm really glad you asked that question, and I don't think it's irrelevant or improper at all. The editor at the University of Chicago Press, who I will say, Doug Mitchell is his name, is a brilliant editor, and he does something which is relatively unusual among academic editors today. He read the book, and he read it closely and thoughtfully, and he said that he thought, coming to mind, the soul and its body represents a new kind of humanism. He saw that humanism that you're referring to very much in the book. He was not just referring to the fact that it's got passages from Lucretius in it and Virgil and that sort of thing, but he was referring to the outlook of the book and the affirmation of the human person that is the thesis of the book. What does poetry have to say to the sciences, and what do the sciences have to say to poetry? Think about, over here at one of our buildings here on campus, we have some quotations from Emily Dickinson, and one of the quotations on the far side of that building a famous line from Emily Dickinson, "The brain is wider than the sky." That phrase was used by Evan Thompson, who is a great brain scientist, as the title of one of his books, where he talks about the immensity of and complexity of the human brain, and how its functioning is not to be understood in terms of the work of a computer, because computers work by algorithms, and the brain makes its own pattern. It doesn't just follow an existing pattern as a computer does. I think he's inspired by Emily Dickinson's remark, which turns out like a rare piece of poetry to be literally true. That is to say, there are more synaptic connections in an individual human brain than there are elementary particles in the universe. That's a pretty remarkable fact, and it gives you an idea of the richness and complexity of the brain. You're never going to have a machine that reads other people's thoughts, because we don't think in the same language. Everybody's thoughts and everybody's memories are developed in a unique way. Think about the fact that a snowflake, which is based on a hexagon, develops enough complexity that in all the snow that has ever fallen on this earth, there are no two snowflakes alike. That's a remarkable thing. And the brain is much, much, much more complicated than a snowflake. So when Emily Dickinson said the brain is wider than the sky, there were truths concealed in what she said beyond what she knew. But she had an intuition of that. When country singers talk about the soul, or poets talk about the soul, they're referring to things that smart scientists need to understand and explain, and when they understand them and explain them, that doesn't consist of eliminating them, that consists of unfolding them and finding out what that richness really is all about. That's why I thought it was appropriate in an afterword to talk about God, because we're seeing a kind of richness in the human brain that makes possible the emergence of the soul and makes it sensible to talk about. Maybe this is a gift of God. Metaphorically, the Bible can talk about that in terms of the breath of life, God breathing into the clay of the human body to make a human being. But that metaphor, again, needs to be unpacked. What does it really mean? There's a wonderful midrash. A midrash is a rabbinic homily. And we used it, we mentioned it in the preface to the book. A couple of guys who were entrusted with guarding the king's fig orchard. One of them was blind and one of them was lame. And they were stealing figs from the king. They got caught, and they had their excuses already. The lame one said, "I never could climb over that wall, I'm lame." And the blind one said, "I couldn't even see where the figs were. I couldn't be out there picking figs." And the king, who was rather canny and not so easily fooled, put the lame man on the blind man's shoulders and punished them together. The story is told in the Talmud as an allegory of the nature of the relationship between the soul and the body. The body is the blind man, which doesn't have any consciousness of its own. And the soul is the lame man, which can't do anything on its own. But the idea is they don't do anything on their own. They work together. It's because they work together that they're effectual. And so we're interested in the integration of the body and the soul. That's something that people who are trying to be idealists and deny that there are any physical things have impoverished themselves. And in the same way, people who are materialists and who deny that there's anything that is properly described in non-physical language, they're impoverishing themselves too. Consciousness can't be described in physical terms. You could, perhaps, in principle, find out what every neuron in the brain was doing. Hard to do. Probably impossible, but in principle you could do it. But knowing what those neurons were doing would not tell you what somebody was thinking. It would not give you those thoughts. Those thoughts are in the realm of the subject, and the subject emerges from the body, but is not describable in its terms, not explainable in its terms. And in that sense, what the poets have to say, and the fiction writers have to say,
and the songwriters have to say,
and the songwriters have to say, that's very, very important. You know, I remember when I was a graduate student studying for my degree, for my doctorate at Oxford, and I had the privilege of hearing one of the great philosophers of the then previous generation, Gilbert Ryle. Ryle is the author of a book called The Concept of Mind, and it's a piece of eliminative reductionistic philosophy published in the late 40s. Ryle was an ordinary language philosopher, which meant that he thought that ordinary language should be the guide of philosophical understanding. And I remember he gave a lecture, and Ryle was famous for saying that a statement was legitimate if it could be expressed in the language of Jane Austen. And I went up to Ryle after the lecture, and I said to him, you know, you've said that a statement makes sense, could be legitimate if it could be in the language of Jane Austen. What about the language of Dostoevsky? And to my great surprise and delight, Ryle said, yes, I think so. That was something that a man who was really thoughtful and was not confined by his own method was capable of saying. He hadn't said the language of Dostoevsky. He was more comfortable with the language of Jane Austen, for understandable reasons. But he could see that there are moral and spiritual dimensions that maybe aren't captured by one writer and might be captured by another. And so the poets have a lot to say to the scientists, and the scientists have a lot to say to the poets, and they shouldn't be at loggerheads with one another.
Thank you. Thank you, Len, for this conversation. As usual, it's been one in which I've learned a lot, as reading the book as well.
Your questions were challenging. I'll tell you, I hope I've done justice to the book. There's a lot more in it than we could possibly, as you said at the beginning. So I hope folks will read the book and see if it makes sense to them.
Great. Again, I've been talking with Len Goodman, professor of philosophy, and Andrew W. Mellon, professor in the humanities, about his recent book, Coming to Mind, The Soul and Its Body, co-authored with Dennis Caramenico, and the book was recently published by the University of Chicago Press. If you have any comments about this conversation, just browse to the homepage of the Vanderbilt Divinity Library and click on the Ask a Librarian link on that page. We look forward to hearing from you, and thanks for listening. I'd like to dedicate this interview to Ben Cobb, a good friend and a faithful listener. He always had smart things to say about each interview, and he would raise questions in his comments to me that I wished I had asked. Ben's life provides another argument for the existence of the soul, and those of us who knew him will miss its absence.